La Captive, I worked a lot in interior spaces, Ackerman said when the film came out. The townhouses, the cars. Through them, the viewer is projected into a mental universe. At the same time, you escape all psychological explanation. You're just caught in a machine that moves forward. Close quote. This is a machine fueled by the character's own desire to be captive or held, to hold or capture each other. The atmosphere may be sensual, but it is also short on oxygen. It leaves one gasping for air. One exits the film with the disquieting sense that we cannot choose to be free, that we are governed and compelled by desires that make us unhappy, that there is no outside to what we desire, no other world that we can get to, no way off the track that is rushing Ariane to her fated end, and that whatever desire wants, it isn't actually to possess the thing it's chasing. Children understand this better than anyone. It's the story of Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner.
Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a special episode. I think in the past I've done, I think maybe a couple of episodes drawing on the Firefly's Press series, the Decadent Editions, which are a series of 10 books about films from the 2000s. And for this time, I'm really, really happy to have the author of the latest one on La Captive, the Chantal Ackerman film, Christine Smallwood. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming to chat about this and about Ackerman and her movies generally. Although you warned me that you might actually be a little tired of contemplating this in particular.
Yeah, I'd like to know what you think about Ackerman.
Yeah. And I mean, for me, I really loved this book. I mean, I've seen La Captive two or three times. I mean, I'm not going to say I saw it 10 times. I don't know. Did you see it multiple times? Watch it multiple times?
I watched it many times at home. Yes.
I actually sometimes have a problem watching things many times because then I weirdly stop seeing it. This happens more with movies than with books for some reason. So the stuff I love the most is sometimes the films I've seen the least somehow. I don't know.
I'm so interested in that. I actually have, like, as a critic, I'm sure you've had a lot more experience than I have seeing something once and then writing about it. Is that true?
Yes, yeah, definitely for reviews.
I have a really hard time with that. I always want to watch something many, many times if I have to write about it and like really like pause it and rewind and pause it and watch certain things over and over. And I think that it's kind of interesting to think about how home viewing technology has changed criticism. I don't know if anybody has really like looked into that, but I would read that book.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, when I think of like, I don't know, to take a stereotypical example, like the, Cahiers du Cinéma, like critics going to see these American movies that they could see suddenly in a flood in the 50s. And, is that where the idea for like Fahrenheit 451 came from, that they were memorizing the credits, just like they would memorize the texts of books or something? But yeah, I guess in those days, you would just have to write the credits or look them up when someone published them or something. To pick the most mundane aspect of writing about a movie.
Yeah, I think it's a really special skill actually to be able to see something once and take it in and then boldly write about it. And I probably also you just kind of get better at seeing things that way,
Bold or I sometimes feel foolhardy doing it, and then it almost becomes like a critical get out of jail free card. I only saw it once, so
Yeah, but you can. I think that like you can fall into a real anxiety hole if you have the option of rewatching it, and then you can just check yourself forever and just keep watching the same thing until you go mad.
it's true. I mean, I should say that this series is people basically doing close encounters. I was going to say close readings with particular films. So it's like a real monograph, book length approach to that. And you mentioned early on that discomfort is what you feel when you watch an Ackerman movie.
Yeah, I think that, Ackerman famously uses these long takes, right, which require you to just sit there and watch. And in some ways, the best Ackerman experience is going to be in the theater, right, where you can't be distracted, you can't pause or look at your phone or get a snack. You just like actually have to be in the moment that she's asking you to be in. But being in that moment can be uncomfortable. I mean, I find that's also true in the documentaries. She holds the camera on the subject's face for such a long time. I mean, much longer than you would allow yourself to look at another person in conversation.
It's true. If you did that, the person would probably want to leave the
Yeah, I
room.
mean, we break eye contact, we look away, and we do that. It's almost like tact to do that, to give someone else that space of not being looked at for a moment.
Yeah, this actually reminds me of something else you wrote. Whenever I say you wrote, it sounds like it sounds like very direct. It is written by you. I mean, related to that, that what she's doing with those documentaries, I really liked what you wrote, that she's letting the other be.
Yeah, that's from her too. I mean, that's something I think she says about herself, and maybe those words are other words, I don't remember.
I mean, it's interesting to contemplate with Ackerman's movies. I mean, one thing about La Captive that I've always really loved is that it's, do you use the word trance? No, I didn't want to put words in your mouth.
I don't remember. I definitely use the word hypnotic. I'm not the only person who's used that word for this movie. The thing about trance, though, is also in La Captive, the character of Simon definitely seems like he's in a trance or he's been hypnotized. Just like the way he walks, kind of floating down the hallway, or he's always kind of vacantly staring into the middle distance. And the feeling of the trance isn't just coming from the formal qualities of the film. It's also, I think, coming from the performances.
No, that's absolutely true. It's really pretty uncanny, his particular gaze, and it really crystallized toward the end of the film. I mean, it almost seems like his eyes are looking slightly different angles from each other as well in this, like, one of the final shots of him
Yeah.
close up. I forget if we've actually like described anything about how their relationship plays out. I mean, you write about how he's interested in her as a kind of keeper of her secrets, and that's what exerts a hold on him, specifically like her relationships with her friends, her girlfriends, and what he makes of that or just cannot comprehend about that. So he kind of situates himself like permanently in this position of like trying to decode or something.
Yeah, so he's jealous, right? I mean, that's like the kind of premise, right? He's jealous. He's becomes increasingly obsessed with whether or not she is cheating on him, specifically whether or not she's cheating on him with women and whether she prefers women sexually to men. But he also, if he knew the answer to those questions, he would completely lose interest in her, right? And so that's the kind of also Proustian story of desire. That you can't actually ever know the thing that you want to know because then you won't want the thing that you had been wanting. It's a happy story about
Yes.
how intimacy is really possible and how we can definitely know each other really deeply and authentically and connect. It's all about connecting.
That's right. It's all about connecting. I mean, he doesn't seem to have a whole lot else going on in his life as well, just in the sense that, I mean, you basically describe him as like a writer who doesn't write Marcel if he never wrote a great novel.
Yeah, so I mean that's the thing about Proust is that so much of Proust's novel is kind of tracking the different ways that Marcel is passing time, right, until he gets down to it to become Marcel Proust, right? And the whole time you're reading it, you know that this like kind of callow, insensitive young man is one day going to like get his shit together and be the greatest writer who ever lived. And Ackerman really takes that away from Simon by kind of like narrowing the frame of what she's dealing with. And so he really is just kind of like a callow, selfish, privileged, neurotic young man.
Is there any way of redeeming him by saying that maybe this is the R&D portion of his writing career?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's not the point. Like, I think that what's interesting about what she's doing is she's taking that character and kind of showing him in the moment, right? In the moment when he can't be redeemed, he can't be transformed.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
And Stanislas Mehar is just such an extraordinary actor. Like what he does with like one eye is just so deep and complex.
I totally agree, and it's such a fascinating performance also because it looks like he's not acting.
Yeah.
It almost looks like, oh, this must be someone who's not usually a film actor or something like that, which is part of what's so great about it. It keeps up this scrim that's between him and the world somehow. I don't know.
Grim is the perfect word for it.
Yeah, the particular gaze that he has. But yeah, it's from Remembrance of Things Past.
Yeah, it's the fifth volume, I think. In the last one, he goes to that party where he sees everyone has aged and he doesn't recognize them at first, which actually happened to me the other day. I was at a party the other day and saw a guy, and could not place him and then realized it was because his hair was completely gray now, as is mine more and more.
I mean, one strange thing about La Captive also is that, not necessarily strange for her films, I guess, but it wasn't like really distributed in the United States. I think I probably saw it on DVD first, and then I saw it probably at BAM after that. Did you see it at, speaking again of like home versus theater, did you see it at home or theater first, or?
So I'm going to tell you the truth, which is that I have never seen it in the theater. And that's why I'm so excited that Metrograph is doing a screening,
Oh, great.
because I'm actually going to get to see it in the theater for the first time and wondering if it's going to really kind of change. Like, I wonder what new ideas I'll have. I'll have to write a sequel, like a theatrical experience.
I like that, like Captive too.
Yeah, La Captive
Bigger,
too. Bigger and better.
and better, right? So how did it work? How did you come to choose this film for your entry in this series?
They asked if I wanted to write one. When they approached me, a number of the years had already been spoken for. A couple of the books had already come out when they approached me. So I think there were only maybe 4 or 5 years left to choose from, if I'm remembering correctly. And, this series, I think, is trying to cover the globe in a certain way, or trying to bring attention to filmmakers like outside of the kind of American, what's the word I'm looking for? Empire. I was drawn to La Captive because it was a chance to write about Ackerman and Proust together. I mean, I write about film, but I usually write about books. And so I felt that it would be kind of making good use of who I am and what I could bring to the series.
And did you have already movies by her that you had liked or meant something to you?
Yeah, I mean, I love John Dielman. I've loved that movie since I saw it. It was one of the movies I saw in college and like my intro to film studies class. I really loved Golden 80s. I like that kind of zany side of Ackerman a lot, which isn't to say I don't like her quote like serious work, but I do also like the fizzier, like zanier, like which is why I spent so much time in the La Captive essay talking about Tomorrow We Move, which is a really unappreciated farce that she made, also starring Sylvie Testud, who plays Ariane in La Captive.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did. I have that on DVD just to nerd out for a second. Actually, weirdly, I have that and A Couch in New York on VHS.
I mean, A Couch in New York is also very funny to me, I think.
It really is. I mean, I don't understand. Why not give her that? There are people who like really kind of dump on that movie, I think, or I've seen that happen, or
Yeah.
just like it's sort of this embarrassing, like, I don't know, detour or something. But why can't she make her like bonkers, like New York apartment movie?
Yeah, I mean, I do think people kind of want Ackerman to be the auteur who made John Dielman, J2ELL, like News from Home, and then maybe to also have made some of her more like politically savvy documentaries, and they don't really want her to also have made A Couch in New York. But we contain multitudes, and I'm really interested in these kind of like more embarrassing corners of her body of work.
And I think that in a way is one of the strands about her work and about La Captive is that kind of resisting just being something classical or canonical or grand in some way. I mean, that's why I was very admiring of your word choice, like when it came down to it, in terms of Simone and Ariane, it's not love making, it's humping,
Yeah, that is what they do. Although actually, a friend of mine, his mother got in touch to say that the word I was looking for was frottage, the French word frottage, which is how they say humping. But I think it's better to just call it humping. It kind of some of the glamour out of
Right, yeah, that is the thing. Like anything in French still sounds, somehow sophisticated very
Yeah.
often. But I mean, I mentioned that, also just it's amazing because if you were to read that in Proust, I mean, what is the corresponding passage to that like in Proust?
Oh, shoot. I wish I had Should I go get it? I mean, it's very similar. You know, he kind of rubs himself on Albertine.
Okay. Well, oh, because I thought it was going to be something like a bit more roundabout or evocative or something like this.
I mean, it sounds beautiful because he's writing it. That's the action that's being described.
Yeah, but it's funny to me because for Ackerman, I just feel like it's always very direct. You know, it's not like she's going to romanticize it in some way. And I mean that it also like unfolds in this like long take. And I don't know. There's so many different tones already also that it goes through. Like it's totally creepy on one level, but it also could be something out of a classical painting of some sort.
Yes, I think there's something really painterly about a lot of the shots in this film.
Yeah. And it's interesting. It seems like I was just looking up, who her cinematographer on this, Sabine Lesselin. And I guess she also worked with her on Tomorrow We Move. But interestingly, not much after that, I guess, or not at all. I mean, the movie starts in just such a quintessentially, like, I hate to say something stupid, like, just like visual way. It's like, it's just this one phrase that is repeated in this broken way. But other than that, I feel like the first 5 minutes are just kind of wordless.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been interesting in a different version of this book. I should have talked about Almayer's Folly, you know, which is her adaptation that she made, I think, in 2011, I want to say. But that movie also has kind of begins with the sea, I think, and also begins with a kind of like wordless. There's that performance in the beginning. Do you remember this at all?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I probably should have written about it, but I didn't.
Well, yeah, I felt like everything was just so well crystallized. But yeah, I mean that opening, sometimes with great movies, the opening, I don't know if this makes sense. The opening is so good and feels so fresh that I forget it, and then the next time I watch it, it's new again.
Yeah.
And that's the case here, opening with the sea, and I love the description you have that it's kind of the camera is like searching the ocean.
Yeah, it's such an interesting movie too because she's not afraid to take on these like two kind of titans, these two like capital G great artists, you know, like Hitchcock and Proust and bring them together. And yet the result is something that is like so completely an Ackerman film.
Yeah. And it's almost like she's also taking apart some of what she does with her movies to a certain extent. Like, I felt like the whole thing with the car, I guess he has these two cars. One is a convertible, one is this grandiose, like, roadster with a driver. And there are all these scenes where he alone is in the car or they're in the car. I mean, it's like Cosmopolis before Cosmopolis.
Totally. Yeah, it's a great driving movie for sure.
But just that sense, the reason I mentioned in relation to her technique is it's like, I mean, one thing she had really been doing a lot of in her movies is these tracking shots, these incredible, like surveys of like people on sidewalks or streets.
Oh, yeah, like from the east, right? Where there's just those really long ones.
Yeah, which no one has ever done that as well. I don't need, it's magical. That's the point where I just fail to explain what's so great about it. But here with the car, I felt it was like we're inside the tracking shot.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I think that's so true.
And sometimes you actually do see what you would see from a camera that is the car, which is the Bois de Boulogne, I guess,
Yeah.
it's one part. But a lot of times you don't, you just have the rear projection in the back behind them.
Yeah, oh, I love that. Yeah, where were you when I was writing this book? I would have taken it. I'm giving you credit. I wouldn't have stolen it. I would have
Okay.
quit.
The sound also, that brings me to the sound in the movie, which I love how that's something that you weave in, your experience, where you're situated when you're writing, or when you were writing this. Because, I mean, in the car, you have that incredible, like, ambient car hum that everyone knows. So you distinguish between ambient and punctuating sounds or noises as something that you have something in common with Proust in terms of when you were writing this, I guess.
Yeah, this is something that Lydia Davis writes about. So Lydia Davis, the fiction writer who also translated the first volume of Proust for these newer Penguin editions, she has this incredible essay called Hammers and Hoofbeats that catalogs all the different sounds that Proust would have heard when he was a child. And she connects it to his like developing sense of rhythm as a writer. And she basically says that Proust would have heard more, quote, punctuating noises and fewer, quote, ambient noises than we do today. Because today we always have these like refrigerators humming or engines or vehicle traffic. She calls it like an unremitting, steady background din. Whereas Proust would have heard like the hoofbeats of horses or carriage wheels or church bells, like noises that began and ended.
So interesting, and to think of that also just within the context of a film where, I mean, all of that is sort of crafted and created. It's a texture of its own. It's another texture that she was creating, and it's funny how that affects the images that you're seeing. So the sense of being, you know, you mentioned that it's like sort of a claustrophobic work, and I wonder how much the sound has to do with that too.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The way Aukerman uses sound throughout her career is really fascinating. You know, of course, because in the beginning, she does kind of experiments with sound. You know, she'll have a voiceover that will like lag or be in advance of the image, so it's not quite lined up. And she has, you know, various rules against soundtracks and so forth. But by the time she's making La Captive, she's embracing more conventional filmmaking techniques. And so we have this really persistent, repeated classical music that really does feel like dread. You know, it's like a kind of like you're kind of being strangled by the soundtrack throughout the film.
It's really interesting. You know, I wondered how much it kind of defines my experience of the movie too, you know, like, and I'd started to wonder when in the process she wanted to put that in there, you know.
It's a really good question. I mean, it's the Rachmaninoff Isle of the Dead, and she's clearly really intentional with it, also because the final scene of the film, she like stages basically a painting by Arnold Böcklin, Island of the Dead, right? And so she's really like making sure that we're noticing what we've been listening to the whole time.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's very true. Yeah, you talk about that. So that would seem to confirm that it was very built in to use that particular piece then.
I think it is. And you know, I think that she uses a lot of classical music in her, like the sort of second half of her career. Like even Tomorrow We Move has a kind of classical, like there's a repeated, I want to say it's Chopin. I think it must have something to do with her relationship with Sonia Weider Atherton, who was a cellist. It's just maybe that's being too biographical, but it feels likely.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah. And then, yeah, you point out that her editor is actually her sister.
Yes, Sonia's sister Claire Atherton.
The way the music, it really sets that tone of, you say something like boredom, duration, but then turning into dread, really, which again is, it does feel somewhat distinct from like her earlier films where you just kind of had to sit with the action itself. You weren't. Not that music would be like a guide rail, but it is something to kind of hang on to, even if it is an unnerving mood.
Yeah, I mean, music really changes the texture of your experience. I mean, I'm probably not the only person who, if I'm watching something scary, I just put it on mute and put the subtitles on, you know, because it's about 70% less scary if you're not listening to it.
Oh, wow. I've never done that. I should try that.
Oh, maybe you don't get scared as easily as I do. Yeah, I mean, I'll turn the music way down so I can't hear it.
I almost want to watch this movie without the sound and then see what that would be like. But it is such a strong presence for me because otherwise, you know, I'm very much guided by the spaces, and you talk about the importance of like interior spaces for her. And this is one of those phrases that I do want to also quote. You talk about how Ackerman's films, her films are like a house where she could live with her mother or her mother's voice or her mother's ghost. So I don't know. I thought that was a really wonderful way of putting it.
Yeah, she's so interested in interiors and in architecture. When she is asked why she wanted to adapt Proust, or when she answers that question, she says that it was about shooting the apartment. She said, "I remember that there was that apartment and the corridor and the two characters. I said, that's a story for me." And I was like so interested in that idea. And she also talks in interviews about how she has to work with hallways and doors and rooms, and they help her work out staging and time. So you start to just kind of extend the metaphor, right? Until the film itself is the house.
Yeah, my memories of Ackerman movies are partly just those particular compositions, you know, which are always often from a doorway, you know, or including the doorway. Or I think like the final shot of like NoHo Movie is like the two doorways in her mother's house, I think. that are just really charged with meaning. But in this case, it's odd. Like, in a sense, I didn't get as much of a sense of the layout of the apartment. I think it's in the movie. I just, because it's somewhat less static, the sense of Simone's apartment, which is this some kind of rambling place where he keeps Ariane, like almost just, I guess you mentioned sort of mapping it out mentally.
I mean, I think the thing about the apartments in Ackerman or the rooms in Ackerman is, I guess the most obvious thing to say is that these are female spaces, right? Or spaces of domestic confinement. I think that's kind of where the interest in them maybe originates. Yeah, this particular apartment is very strange. There's just no common space in it. So you have Simon has a bedroom on one side of it, and then Ariane has a bedroom on the other side of it, and there's this hall. And it to me, it feels like fully a third of the movie is them going up and down the hall to visit each other's bedrooms. And then he has this study that once or twice he goes into. But I mean, there's no like kitchen. The apartment is under renovation. It's just like it's a very strange space.
Well, you almost get the sense that they're like ghosts already, in that they're just haunting this apartment somehow.
And that, it's the grandmother's apartment, right? And like he lives with the grandmother, and then she's kind of like living there too. And these relationships are the relationship with the grandmother is more like implied. Ackerman doesn't really spell things out. Like, what does the grandmother think of Ariane? That's just not a relevant question for the movie.
Yeah, which is strange since you point out, the presence of the mother is so significant in Proust. But yeah, here it's just they kind of skip right to the grandmother.
Yeah, it's kind of beautiful. I mean, the grandmother has a really haunting face.
Yeah, I guess in a way she also feels like a ghost to me. That's like a ghost haunting his ghost somehow.
Yeah, well, there's like that scene in the beginning when Ariane and Simon are like trying to be intimate, and then you hear the grandmother coughing through the wall, and Simon has to go fetch a glass of water.
Yeah. But also the way they, have dressed him, the particular like costume design he's wearing, I guess still like kind of like mid late 90s kind of heavy overcoat where you feel like if you touch it, he might just turn dust inside and disappear.
Everything about the clothes and the interiors in this film is just really incredible. And just the year 2000 is such an interesting year,
Yeah.
right? It's like a bridge year,
Yeah.
and I say a little bit about this in the book, but it's like just before cell phones. It's just before everybody had a cell phone, which I find to be like a really poignant, interesting cultural moment.
Right. Just before that, so, it would be like a cordless phone would be the height of technology, or I guess the technological power move you describe, which is perfect. This is a very funny book. I mean, I don't know. I guess people who know your writing probably know that, but it's used the power move of using the remote control for your stereo system.
Right. Right. Yeah, I love that scene in the film. They're in bed and he takes out the remote and like turns the stereo on, and sound just floods the room.
Yeah. But no, absolutely. This kind of bridge moment, which then ends up feeling like a moment kind of lost in time, but it's perfect also for the senses of like distance and absence. And then I start thinking just of the visual ways that Ackerman explores that, which brings me to like the tub scene, which is just amazing. And also just they have one of the like kind of pivotal like compositions or like framings in the movie.
Yes, absolutely. Where he's in the tub and she's in the shower right behind him. It's really exceptional. I mean, I'm not sure I have anything brilliant to say about it. It's a beautiful shot. Like, there are just so many beautiful shots in the film.
Yeah, they're separated by, what is the word for that type of glass?
Oh, is it smoked glass? Or no, it's like opaque. It's like if you have a glass shower door and you don't want people
That's it.
to be able to see every single thing. But you can, I mean, it's sexy also. It's like a sexy, erotic scene. I think I've heard people call this an erotic thriller, and I think that's the scene they're thinking of.
Wait, who calls the Captive an erotic thriller? I love this.
I think I just did. I've heard myself call this movie.
that I'm disputing it, but I mean, that's the thing. Like, you can reframe the movie in different ways. I mean, it's true. It starts out very, obviously, very vertigo-like, just pursuit.
Yes.
Yeah, this kind of wordless pursuit, and I guess it's left in the air too, left hanging a bit. How much she's aware of this or not? I couldn't tell. Like, is this also just some part of a whole elaborate like game or ritual that she never tips her hand in that regard, really, does she?
Yeah, there's a lot that we can't know about this movie, I think. And it just raises a lot of questions that it doesn't give us the tools to answer. That's one question, you know, like, is Ariane aware that Simon is following her? It seems like she must know, but she doesn't betray that she knows. And then is she actually cheating on him, right? Or is this all, is he driving himself crazy over nothing, or is there something there? I think ultimately we're led to conclude that she is cheating on him, but it's not like definitive, you know, like Ackerman doesn't like produce evidence of it.
I kind of love that too, because it doesn't demand that of her, that she, issue like a verdict on what she's doing for us.
Yeah, and in some ways she can't. Like the power of the film is that we don't know and we can't know. And so it keeps us interested, just like Ariane is keeping Simon interested.
Yeah. And I mean, coming back to like that theme of pursuit that goes on, I really like this moment where you're describing Ariane's heels, the clicks of the heels, and kind of what that signifies, because I think that triggered for me thinking about what the pursuit means or stands in. And I began to think of the pursuit. It felt to me like that's a form of memory, and that he's always chasing, he's turning her into a memory that he's always chasing and is always one step behind. And then from that slippage is where he might write something but has not actually written anything. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense, especially when you look back at the very beginning of the film. After that shot of the sea, we get him watching like Super 8 footage from the beach where he met Ariane, and like trying to kind of reclaim the way he saw her then. The film sets us up to understand our whole relationship, right? As him kind of like reclaiming what had happened.
Yeah. And I have to say, at a certain point, I did find, not that this is really relevant, but I really felt like a characteristic of Simone is he's insufferable.
Totally.
I couldn't stand him after a while.
Yeah, he's very hard. And you start to wonder, like, what is she doing with him? And there's the moment where they almost break free of each other, right? I mean, like, so he finally breaks up with her, and then he drives her to her aunt's house in the countryside, and the aunt isn't in, and they sit in the living room and have this sort of tortured conversation, and then basically decide not to break up after all. And it's a kind of devastating moment because I think for a lot of people, myself included, you're really ready for them to split up at that point.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, as well, for a lot of people, that whole process also seemed like a familiar choreography.
Oh yes. That's just breaking up is just a stage of staying back together, being together, right?
That's where the kind of trance-like quality of him comes into play, because it's almost like he's just like sleepwalking right back into it when he starts saying like, "So maybe a few more weeks," you know?
Yeah, right back into it. Yeah, they've really got a hold on each other, those two.
Although it's I mean it's a hold, which, spoiler alert, yeah, she escapes. And I kind of was curious if you can talk about how you came to understand her actions at the end of the movie.
Yeah, so the end of the movie is quite mysterious. So they drive to Biarritz, and she is clearly kind of miserable in his presence. And they check into this very strange hotel room. And I mean, I don't know where she shot it, but they're basically in like a sort of empty ballroom, it looks like. And they order like food that a waiter is going to bring in. And then she decides that she's going to go swim, and it's nighttime. And she swims out too far, right? And he tries to save her, and she's drowned. I mean, it's the kind of thing, I watched it so many times at home, and it's so dark. You know, you can't really see everything that's happening. You can see him sort of like they're thrashing around together, right? And then she goes down. The big question for the viewer is, does she swim out to kill herself, or does she swim out just for a moment to be alone and then accidentally drowns? And again, that's one of those questions that the film doesn't really give us an answer to, but either way, we know that Simon is somehow responsible for what's happened.
Yeah, it's a terrible, in I don't know, like the old-fashioned sense of the word, sequence. It's just really amazing.
Yeah, it's the only ending. You know what I mean? It's like it would be very difficult to know how to end that movie otherwise, I think.
And that, of course, concludes his pursuit, I guess, because he does not follow her unto or beyond into death, I guess.
No, although it's interesting because his face at the end of the movie is so stricken, right? And he's like in hell now. And so it's sort of like I wouldn't want to say that he is also dead in some way, but he is kind of like beyond life and death in that last shot, which again is, and I did not say this in the book, but we can talk about it now. Like the last shot of Almayer's Folly is also Stanislas Marhar's face kind of like flickering in this near death state, you know, like not physically near death, but a kind of like spiritual death.
If I remember correctly, that's when he's just sort of th sitting in this room, this kind of twilight room almost.
Yeah, and the light is just kind of passing over the architecture of his face.
I wrote about that movie once, and it was so hard to write about. I mean,
Oh, what did you say?
I mean, this is, I guess, another strand a little bit in her work. I connected it a bit with like a sense of madness. I don't know that at that point he's for me that shot. I mean, there are a couple of ways that I thought about the shot. I mean, one is that there is some spiritual bereftness or some sort of bereftness, but also it felt like, not to use pathological language, but it felt like very dissociated. So that was very much like in play for me, and that I find that like hard to the point of impossible scene to watch somehow, and even to end a movie on. It's just but I love that you're putting them side by side, because putting one that is definitely a point of no return, and wherever he is in that scene, whether that is a point of no return as well.
It does seem like he's not going to come back from that place at the end of Almayer's Folly. Like now he's kind of really descended into, I think madness is an appropriate word.
Yeah, but even when I used that word afterwards, I felt I didn't want to like pathologize it somehow, or in a sense, madness is already a bit of a lyrical word.
Yeah, it's too romantic, right?
But I don't know. And then, being aware of, you mention, you start off one of the kind of subsections with mentioning Ackerman's, having a manic episode, and then how afterwards, life definitely felt different for her. So having that awareness too, somehow, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Her own story is a difficult one.
Yeah. Well, I love how much you write about sleep in this book.
Yeah, well, the Ackerman's interest in sleep is really, it goes across her whole career. You know, she's always filming people falling asleep or herself falling asleep. Yeah, sleep is a really interesting part of the relationship in La Captive just because Ariane falls asleep. It's their sexual thing. Like she falls asleep and then they can have sex. Or she pretends to sleep and then they can have sex. And tracking that throughout the film was one of my interests.
And then you intertwine that with just your experiences, I guess, putting your children to bed, which, sorry, I'm going to quote something else back to you just because it's so fun. All I want is for the people I live with to sleep when I tell them to sleep.
Oh my God, right? I mean, that is like the ultimate superpower to just be able to put, it's sort of like being able to freeze time. Remember in Sabrina the Teenage Witch, was that the where she could just freeze time? Or no, there was a different one when we were kids where somebody could freeze time and then move people around. Do you remember what I'm talking about? It was like also like a probably a Nickelodeon show of some kind. Anyway, yeah, being able to put other people to sleep is a form of control that nobody has. You cannot make another person sleep. And yet Simon will suggest to Ariane, like, if you want to sleep, you can, and then she just does it. So it's kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah, she can do it. But yeah, I just also that you compare like waiting for lying with the children as they're going to sleep or not going to sleep, that there's no like experimental cinema that could possibly compare.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot because Ackerman always talks about wanting people to experience the passing of time, right? That's her thing. And she doesn't want to steal hours from the viewer's life. She wants to make the viewer experience it. And I think that that is a fascinating and important thing that art can do. But also, I was at a place in my life while I was writing this book that I felt like I was really in touch with the passing of time in this one particular way, which had to do with my kids' bedtimes. So the idea of like sitting down for a work of difficult cinema to teach me that lesson was not one that I needed to learn.
I don't know if you actually say it as explicitly as
I mean,
that,
it's implied. I mean, I really quite like durational art of all form of all kinds. Like it's something I'm really interested in. But you know, at different moments in life, we might, you know, see those things differently.
it's just a slightly, I get it. It's basically like, No, but I think that is really interesting that she does return to sleep or troubled sleep. And yeah, and that even waking existence can be somewhat, dreamlike or sleep-like, or like you're traveling. I don't know, you're traveling in your mind. I mean, I don't know. One of my favorite movies of her is still News from Home,
Oh, yes, an amazing movie.
where you're traveling, not traveling through the city, and then traveling, not traveling through the voiceover letters. I don't know. That's,
Yeah, that's a really extraordinary movie.
yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there's so much more we could talk about. I love La Captive. I hope everyone reads this book. The weird thing that I come back to when you said like the discomfort is what you feel from the movie, because the thing I've never been able to explain about La Captive is that the rhythm feels right. It just glides along in some way, but is also, as you say, like there's such a discomfort to it. I don't know how she accomplishes that. Well, I guess we can wrap up there. Sorry, that's a terrible phrase. I guess we can conclude.
That's a wrap. Are you in like a director's chair? You're gonna clap a
That's right.
little bit.
Last but not least, we'll finish the episode in the traditional manner, and that is, what is the last thing you saw?
Last thing I saw was Kurosaki's The Match Factory Girl, which my husband and I watched at home on the recommendation of our friend Dan Fox. And it was amazing. I had never seen it before.
Oh wow. I remember just the colors of it, like feeling like it was some kind of, I don't know, comic strip come to life in a way.
I had the corniest thought about it. This was all these incredible shots of the factory apparatus itself, that's making the matches. And I was like, oh, yes, this is what cinema does. It puts a frame on something and turns it into art. It was just like the clearest illustration of that when you see the machine doing its work, and it's the patterns and the colors are just so incredible to watch.
Yeah. Well, then, in a way, that brings us back to Ackerman, I guess, the framing.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming in and talking about it and hearing me ramble about La Captive. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is a real treat.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.